Hello, I'm Dr. John Davis. Let me introduce myself to you just a little bit before we talk about psychology. I graduated from Georgia State University several times and have a PhD in counseling psychology. And from there, went on to work in about every field of psychology that there is to work in. I've worked in schools for emotionally disturbed children. I have worked in mental hospitals. I have done private practice, both in family counseling and individual counseling. And I've worked in the business world for a good number of years, teaching psychological principles to managers. So that is a little bit about my background, or at least the psychology side of it. I also have another doctorate in naturopathic medicine. There is actually, in my classes that I teach, a chapter in the book on wellness, so this fits in quite well with the psychology. In fact, I got into wellness and the medical side of things because I felt like psychology did not explain the entire spectrum of human behavior, that some of it at least was being brought about by hormonal issues, other biochemistry in the body. So as I began to see that or feel that, I decided it would be time to go back and get a second degree, second PhD, doctorate rather. So let's talk about psychology. I'm going to assume that you're actually about to read a book of some kind about psychology, either a textbook, you're taking a course in psychology, or you are about to pick up a popular book of some kind about it. And I want to just give you an overview of what it is and what it's about. It would be the kind of thing you might find in chapter one of many college textbooks. You have to kind of understand that psychology is probably not what you think it is. It's certainly not what you see on TV. We have kind of a distorted view of psychology in the general public because of the way it is shown on television. You may remember the psychologist on The Sopranos, for example. And it's not that there aren't psychologists like this who operate in that way. There certainly are, and many of them do very effective work, but there are many other kinds of people who are doing various kinds of therapy, and many that aren't doing therapy at all. Many psychologists who are doing research or teaching or many other kinds of things, working with emotionally disturbed kids, working with mental patients, that kind of thing. So there is a lot going on out there besides what you see on TV in terms of therapy. And the kind of therapy that you see on TV is usually very specific. It's usually analytical, that is psychoanalytic, Freudian therapy. And that type of therapy is really only being done in and around New York and maybe a couple of other places in the country, not very much anyplace else. The other kinds of therapy you'll see are quite different from what you see on TV. Other people have had maybe a bad experience with psychology because they had one bad therapist along the way, or they got caught up in the medical model and were given drugs or recommended to have drugs, and they did not want to get involved with that. So it is quite possible to have a bad experience with the therapist. Not every therapist is good at what they do, and there are a great many good ones out there, so if you ever do have a bad experience, it's a good idea to try again. The other thing about psychology is that many people are suspicious of it. They're afraid that someone who knows anything about it is going to read their mind, and this is not going to happen. It's a little bit odd being a psychologist and having people be so suspicious of you. I will go to a party, for example, and when people find out what I do for a living, they'll say, "Oh, are you analyzing me?" And my usual reply to that is, "Are you paying me?" And they'll say, "No." I said, "Well, I'm not analyzing you then." analysis of any kind takes a great length of time. Very specific questions have to be asked. A lot of exploration into the person's troubles and their life, and definitely is not the kind of thing that will be done at a party of any kind, or really even in a casual relationship. And it's definitely not mind reading, in spite of some of the TV shows that you might see. Now, the exception to that is that there are certain movements of the face or movements of the eyes that indicate that someone might be lying, and I say might be because you do not know for certain by these kinds of things. It's just that people do tend to do certain things when they are evading the truth, and there is a show on TV concerning that, and the show makes it sound like it's a lot more exact a science than it really is. Well, let's talk about whether or not psychology is a science. And if you were to have to decide whether it were an art or a science, or what end of that spectrum it was most toward, it'd be interesting for me to know what you would pick. Let's say art is on one end of the spectrum and philosophy, and then on the other end is chemistry, biology, physics, those kinds of sciences. Where along, say, a 10-point scale would you put psychology? Well, I would put it at about a 7, toward the biology, chemistry, physics end, because there's much more research that has happened and has gone on in psychology than you might imagine. It is no longer the philosophical field that it used to be. And part of the reason that people believe that it belongs on that end of the spectrum is that it used to be more of a philosophy. Early on in psychology, there was very little research done. It was just some very smart people who were putting together a framework, a way of looking at others, and these frameworks were quite different, and they would argue among themselves concerning who was correct, but no one was doing any real research, or at least no research beyond case studies. So there was no way to tell who was exactly correct. You just pick the person who sounded the best to you and went to see them, and if you could get some help, great, and if you couldn't, then you probably condemned the entire field of psychology. The early therapists, for example, were Freud, Jung, and Adler, who met together and talked, but had very different points of view. None of the three, did very much research. Adler, in fact, said, "Why should I do research? I know what's going on." And Freud did his research with individuals who would come to see him, and so he had a very biased sample of people that he was drawing his conclusions from. And I don't know what to say about Jung. He drew his conclusions from his own self, from his inside, from his thinking, from his speculation about very what we could call off the wall kinds of things. But he's very interesting, great fun to read, and a lot of New Age things come out of Jung's ideas. Well, anyway, there are a lot of these were early therapists, but there were other early psychologists around doing research, and not really research, but coming up with theories. But in more recent times, it has become more important to do research in psychology. The world of psychology right now is trying very hard to be seen as a science. Every psychologist is sort of involved in that movement toward being seen as a science rather than more of a philosophy. So it is possible to still be a famous psychologist, but the way to be a famous psychologist today, in today's world, is not to come up with a wonderful theory that sounds great to a bunch of people. It's more to come up with an excellent study of some kinds, an excellent research study that proves that something exists or something doesn't exist. And that way you can become somewhat famous, although, as I said, it's very difficult in today's atmosphere to become a famous psychologist. There are a few people around who have done such remarkable studies that, especially those we'll talk about later in social psychology, that who have become famous. All right, so it is mostly now a scientific field because of that research and because the journals require that that kind of research, very scientific research, be done before they accept an article. It's not perhaps as concrete or as definite as chemistry or physics. I mean, chemists and physics, for example, don't sit around arguing about the composition of water. They know what it is, and so over dinner they won't be saying things like, well, I think it's H2O. And somebody else will say, well, no, I've been thinking about that. I don't think it is H2O. I think it's maybe H3O or something like that. You're not going to hear that kind of conversation in the field of chemistry. But you may hear that kind of conversation still in the field of psychology. But if you do, then somebody sitting at that table is going to say, well, why don't you go do a study on that and let's find out for sure. Psychologists still do argue some about what makes people tick, and there are what that has developed into is various points of view, various ways of looking at a person or a group's psychology. And let's look at some of those different ways that are out there these days, ways to look at different people's psychology. First of all, there's the neuroscience perspective, and these are all called perspectives. And these have to do with how the body and brain enable emotions and how memories occur, how sensory experiences occur, and particularly in the brain and somewhat in the rest of the body. We want to know in this field how blood chemistry is linked with moods and how messages are transmitted through the body, through the nerves. So that's neuroscience, and a very legitimate and interesting field of psychology. The second one we could talk about is evolutionary psychology, and this one is very interesting, although there's not good research behind it, because they tend to explain things after the fact. But what they're interested in is, how does natural selection or survival of the fittest promote certain characteristics in people? In other words, how does evolution influence behavior tendencies? So that's what evolutionary psychology is all about, and probably comes under fire and criticism more than the other fields, but has some things to say to us, particularly about how men and women react to each other and that sort of thing. Behavior genetics is another field that's not far from neuroscience. It's also sort of the physical side of psychology. And here we want to know how much our genes and the environment together influence individual differences. How do genes interact with the environment? That sort of thing. How does that lead to different levels of intelligence and different personality and sexual orientation, those kinds of issues. Then we have psychodynamic, the psychodynamic perspective, and this perspective is basically Freudian, but can be other people, and it has to do with how behavior comes from the unconscious. How is it, how much does behavior happen without our true planning, without thinking it through? It just comes out of our unconscious. That is the issue that is covered in the psychodynamic perspective. Along about 1950 or so, the behavioral perspective became very popular. It had been around before that with John Watson, but then B.F. Skinner came along and did his homework. He did the research and came up with many principles of how and why behavior occurs, and particularly the frequency of certain behaviors. His idea was that there's no such thing really as an crazy behavior, that it's the frequency of behavior that's a problem. For example, let's take crying. He'd say crying's a very normal thing. Everybody does it in their life. But if you cry five times a day, that's a problem. That's crazy. So it's a matter of frequency. So he was interested in observable responses, and the behaviorists always start there and then move on to determine why those observable responses occur. And particularly it's through association or positive reinforcement or observational learning, those kinds of issues. We'll talk more about it later. Cognitive perspectives, another area, have to do with how your beliefs affect your behavior. And Skinner and the behaviorists would have just called those antecedents, but the cognitive people believe that the belief is the core of what makes us tick and why we do what we do. It also includes the fields of reasoning and problem solving and that sort of thing. So it's a pretty broad field in and of itself. But to me, the most interesting part is how does what we believe influence our behavior? An example of that would be, let's say I believe that there's only one person out there for me to have as a partner, and if I find that person, then that's wonderful. And then if I lose her, then it's horrible, terrible, and catastrophic. Let's say I have that set of beliefs, and then I fall in love with someone at age 20 who I think is that person, and then she dumps me. I think we still use that term. And she dumps me, and then what? If I have that set of beliefs, then I'm ruined. And the rest of my life, I may struggle with the fact that I lost my one true love, the only one out there for me. And I may go into a deep depression and not even hunt for another partner. Well, if I have a different set of beliefs, like this set, for example, and there are more fish in the sea than that. There are other people that I could connect with and others that I could love and settle down with and that sort of thing. As long as I have that set of beliefs, then I'm going to respond very differently. I'm going to probably feel a little bit bad when I get dumped for a few weeks, but then move on. Unlike the person who had the first set of beliefs and may for many, many years be stuck before they finally realize they can move on to someone else. So the cognitive or the thought changed the behavior depending on the difference in the thoughts. Sociocultural perspective has to do with how does behavior and thought and emotion and facial expression and all of those sorts of things, how does that change across society, from society to society or culture to culture? So it's a very interesting field of study to take a look at the different cultures. Now, the different models, two basic models of therapy are the medical model and the psychological model. And in the medical model, you're going to find psychiatrists. And in the psychological model, you'll find psychologists. And you need to know the difference between those two to begin with. Psychiatrists have a medical degree, and psychologists do not. Psychologists have several degrees, most likely, in psychology, where psychiatrists may only have a residency in psychology and a couple of courses. So it's a very different kind of thing. Psychiatrists can prescribe medicines, and psychologists typically cannot. Then, among psychologists, there are usually two different kinds. They've come to overlap a great deal now, but you may find a counseling psychologist or a clinical psychologist. And typically, the clinical psychologists deal with the more serious problems, and the counseling psychologists deal with more of the day-to-day challenges of life. But they overlap so much now, it almost makes no sense to differentiate between the two. All right, well, let's call it a day for talking about an introduction to psychology and its subfields and the different types of psychologists. And the next podcast, I will talk about the various methods of research that are used in psychology. There are several different methods, and the experimental method is the most respected and the most frequently used one these days, although surveys and case studies and other kinds are used as well. All right, so thank you for listening to this first of many podcasts in psychology. I'm Dr. John Davis, and I'll talk to you again soon.